Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Slash Filmcast. I'm David Chen, and with me is...
Devendra Hardwar.
And it's just the two of us for now. You know, Devendra, our lives, the three of us here on the Slash Filmcast, I mean, things have rapidly spiraled out of control.
Right? Oh, yeah. It's pure insanity. yeah. It's hard to even do a show anymore.
Yeah. Here's what's going on right now is my job is picking up in terms of intensity, my full-time job. I don't do this stuff full-time. I have an actual job other than this. And that's getting pretty busy. And Jeff Cannata, he's taking care of both of his kids tonight. And so he may or may not join us for our review of Mandy. And Devendra Hardwar, you got one on the way. You got a bun in the oven, right?
Got a bun in the oven. Got a baby on the way. I'm freaking out, man.
Yeah, tell us a little bit. Tell us a little. So your wife is due in a few weeks, right?
Yeah, mid-October.
So literally, it could happen at any moment. Like during this podcast, you could get a text saying, "Stop the podcast. We're going to the hospital." Right? Yeah. That's a thing that could happen. Right?
It's a thing. Like we don't have any control over this whole process. So you kind of just go with the whole flow. And I feel like that's good training for everything.
Yeah. So,
we just had the baby shower. Got to see a lot of friends and family, and now it's just full on, you know, baby prepping and everything, and you know, figuring out how I manage work and everything along with this.
Yeah. So, like, what are some of the things you're thinking through as you're prepping? You know,
mainly like when do I take some time off? Thankfully, I have a decent amount of paternity leave, so nice. I have to like split up that time. But you know, it's tough, and it's a busy season in the tech world, and you know, but things are also really difficult with the child stuff. Like I want to be able to do everything I can to help my wife out too. So it's a crazy balance.
You want to be a good father, good husband.
Yeah.
Like are there things in your life that you look over your life, your existence, and you're like, these are things I'm just, I'm ready to give up. I'm ready to give this stuff up, you know? Like,
well, I mean, it's like with any major life thing, right? There are certainly things just like getting up and going to see a movie that's, you know, playing at 11 PM or something. I may not be able to do as often. But you know, you get a lot in return, right? You're replacing it with something else, potentially much more valuable.
All right. Well, looking forward to seeing how it changes your entire worldview, Devendra.
Oh yeah. Yes.
But, suffice to say, it's been pretty crazy here. And so, the month of October is going to be probably pretty different for the Slash Filmcast is my guess. There might be episodes where, only one of us is here. You know, and maybe has a guest or two. Like that's very possible that is how it's going to play out. So just be ready for anything in October. We might do like some best of episodes, like a rebroadcast or two of some of our best stuff. Anything is possible. Anything is possible, which is kind of unfortunate just because October is a big month in terms of movies, right?
Yeah. There's a lot happening. Yeah.
You got Venom. You got Star is Born. You got, Bad Time at the El Royale? Is that what the movie's called?
Yeah.
Really psyched about all those movies.
Mm-hmm.
First Man is coming out.
I know how much you're excited for Venom, Dave. Like, just
I'm so psyched for Venom.
Wait.
It's like on my most anticipated movies of the year. To take a crap all over on the podcast. So I'm really interested to see how October shakes out. So like we know it's a big month. It's also a big month for all of us on the podcast in terms of our lives. And so just be ready for anything. What comes next month?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, let's dive into the show. What are we going to talk about today? We got some what we've been watching for you, and then we got an in-depth review of the new Nicolas Cage movie Mandy, which was out in theaters recently. It's also out on video on demand right now. So that's what we got in store for you. But before we get to any of that, let's get to some emails and follow-up. This email comes in from Luke, who writes into slashfilmcast@gmail.com. And in the future, please let us know where you're writing from. Luke writes in, how do you guys organize and keep track of your physical media? I don't have much in the way of living space, so I usually just stuff things into drawers or stack them on top of each other whenever there's space. But I don't do anything to organize them or keep track of what I own, which has me worried about losing them and not remembering what I own. Do you know of any apps that are good for that sort of thing that don't cost too much? Or do you think a simple spreadsheet is enough? So that's the email from Luke, who writes into slashfilmcast@gmail.com. So physical media and organizing it.
Yeah. But actually organizing it digitally is what it sounds like the question really is. And in that case, I don't do anything. I know people who do spreadsheets. I know there are apps, and I should probably do that. I will say, if you're just stuffing movies in drawers and stuff, that's start with organizing the actual physical media. So get a nice tall bookcase, make use of all your vertical space, because that's all very useful. And, you know, stacking things is really good because you're not going to use that stuff, that space next to your ceiling anyway. So that's good. And that's kind of what I do. I have a nice, really nice custom bookshelf thing my wife made up.
I've been getting back into physical media recently, Devendra. You know, for a long time, I was just digital only. But I think recently, I've started appreciating the joys of owning physical media. The quality is often better.
And also, 4K Blu-ray, man, it's a miracle. What we're getting on these discs is, you know, equivalent to what's being shown in most movie theaters. Like, that's insane to me. It's $20. For a movie I love, like, yes, I will own that and hold on to that disc forever. It's not something that's going to go away, you know, when the licensing agreement with iTunes goes away or something.
I think Devendra has the right idea. Like, very good tips, Devendra. I don't use anything digital at all. I do alphabetical, right? Which I think is, and it doesn't even need to be exactly alphabetical. I think approximate alphabetical is actually acceptable. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? As long as you have like all the letters in one place, you don't need to get too strict about making it super alphabetical. The purpose of organizing is just to make sure you have a way to find it. And if you organize it roughly alphabetically, it's fine. You're right. A lot of vertical space in houses is unused, so I'd recommend people use that. I have these tall bookshelves and organize it alphabetically. And big fan of the physical media these days. I know a lot of people like do this thing where they get the physical media and then they rip it, which is actually pretty time consuming, right? You need a couple of apps and a Blu-ray drive to rip it, and then they store it on like some server and they stream it from Plex. You know, I know several people who do this, and that seems like a really awesome way to do it, but that's just like a little too intense for
so
me.
Much
like,
work.
It's just a lot of work.
Especially with like you use your ultraviolet slips, use the, you know, the digital copies. At least do that, and I found that to be really good, especially with Movies Anywhere and everything.
But I think, you know, the quality is probably better, right? If with the Plex thing as well, because you can rip it losslessly. You know what I'm saying?
It depends. So, but yeah, man, that is a huge file.
Yeah, those are huge files. That. Like 50 gigs, I think, or something, you know, something like in that range. Mm-hmm. I admire so those work. People. I admire those people, but I can't be one of them, you know?
Yeah.
I wish I could be one of them, but I can't. I'm just
you know
not
what's great?
Enough.
Typing in a code and having a thing that shows up in your Apple TV or whatever, and you hit play and it boom, there you go. It's awesome.
I will say this, that my wife has this soft rule for the Blu-rays, which is that we are now on a fairly strict one-in-one-out policy. Right? So because there are Blu-rays on there. I have Blu-rays on my shelf that are like unopened. Do you know? Blu-rays that I've purchased and never watched, or Blu-rays that I've received for free from like a past life where I was reviewing Blu-rays for some site or whatever. And so I just have a bunch of Blu-rays that I don't get much rotation, you know, in my media diet. And those are going to be the first to go whenever
Give them out to friends, give them some
to libraries,
to friends, whatever.
There's this whole thing, by the way. Have you heard of Buy Nothing? Have you heard of this phenomenon called Buy Nothing?
Nope.
Communities around the United States organize Facebook groups where you can literally just give things away for free rather than throwing them away. And they're called
Buy
Nothing.
Craigslist.
Like it's like Craigslist, but like less sketchy, in my opinion, because it's on Facebook, so everyone needs to use their real identity. And so we'll just buy nothing a bunch of Blu-rays, donate them to the senior center. Anyway, just to finish off that point, Buy Nothing, I'd recommend it because it's kind of a way to connect with neighbors, and like by claiming their stuff or giving away your free stuff. And you kind of feel like, oh, at least my old Blu-ray is going to someone who's going to actually watch it versus just going into the trash, or if you Goodwill it, you have no idea where it's going
to
go.
The last Blu-ray I gave away, by the way, was Downsizing. I gave it to a friend so he could hate watch it. He's really excited about that. So
I mean, that movie,
stuff like that.
That movie is pretty bad.
Bad.
I think Jeff Cannata put that as like one of his top 10 movies of 2017.
We'll just talk about this while Jeff isn't here. I want that thing out of my house immediately.
I'm not exactly sure who said this, So I'm not going to try to attribute the quote, but it was someone on Twitter. It's not my thought, but someone said, like, downsizing is like if you made a movie whose premise is about shrinking someone down to a tiny size and then made the character's journey not have anything to do with that premise. Right? Like, that movie basically could have happened without the downsizing premise, pretty much.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
At least a lot of it could have. You know, not all of it, but a significant part of it. It feels like a lot of untapped potential there. That movie really stuck under my craw because of the, like, it just, you got Alexander Payne, you got, you know, Matt Damon, and
could have been so good.
Christoph Waltz. Yeah, it could have been really good, but it wasn't. It was pretty bad. It's a pretty bad movie. So anyway, you give Blu-rays away for people to hate watch. That's another way to approach it as well. But here's what I've seen, Devendra, that I'm really intrigued by, which is, I think Peter Serena showed me his setup. And what he does is he has like a set of drawers, right? That
a set of what?
A set of like a case with.
I like the way you say drawers.
Drawers?
Drawers.
Drawers?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay.
He has a sequence of things that you pull out, you know, drawers. What am I pronouncing drawers wrong? Is that a weird way to pronounce? Anyway, you have me all self-conscious.
It's very perfectly pronounced.
Yeah.
It's
thank you.
I'm not used to that.
Good. So, what he does is he has like sleeves, right? Like little kind of soft sleeves where he'll remove the Blu-ray art. And then put that in the sleeve and then put the disc in there, right? And that way it takes up way less space. Like you're not putting you're not using a whole Blu-ray case. And so you can fit like hundreds of Blu-rays in like a tiny, you know, bread box size container. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like a great way to go. And like eventually I think I might head in that direction. You know,
yeah. Except for like steel cases, because you kind of want to have those, right?
That's the thing. There's some Blu-ray cases that are just like too good to not use. You know, so that's the only downside of that. But if you want something easily accessible, like get like some sleeves going, right? Some soft sleeves. Take the Blu-ray art out, put the disc in there, put it in a drawer, and I think that is a good way to organize physical media. So
yeah, there's a lot of, like that company Kaleidoscape. If you remember that they make that big machine that can hold like hundreds of DVDs and Blu-rays, like eventually, like that's where you want to be. You want to have something like that to be truly galaxy brain. That thing can also rip your movies, I believe, for you automatically and just store them on a giant ass server. That is like the ultimate solution, but it's crazy expensive. That's for people who have like, you know, a little theater room in their house or something.
Kaleidoscape. Yeah. Looks like it can store approximately 180 DVDs. This is from the 2005 press release, so maybe
that's the old one. They have some new ones too. Like you could suck down 4K digital files that are basically what's in the theaters too.
That is impressive. That is impressive. So anyway, those are a few ideas for organizing physics. I don't know if this is at all helpful.
Start with the bookshelf.
Start with the shelf that, like, the Devendra goes all the way to the ceiling. Start with that. And work your way up to maybe putting it in the tiny sleeve and putting it in a tiny case. And or, you know, some people will use those like big CD books. You know what I'm saying? That's a little too intense because you can't really fit a Blu-ray art in there. You know what I'm saying?
It is. You know, that is, I like traveling with those. If I'm like going home and I want to bring some movies to my parents, I have a small like 50, you know, DVD case and I just travel with that. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
But not for home stuff. Like that reminds me of like, when we were just burning tons of CDs and like you'd have, you know, books and books filled with CDs. I don't want to go back to that life.
Yeah.
That was a dark time.
Dark time. Dark time in our lives. We have nice Blu-ray cases. We got digital copies now. I would put them all on a shelf, put them all in a bookcase. This guy, Luke, sounds like he has so many. He doesn't even know. It sounds like he's not even putting them all in one place. Right.
And then once you see them, you know what to get rid of. And that's also the key.
Yeah.
Instead of just hiding them everywhere.
I would definitely recommend like a one in one out policy, though. I think that's like if you have like an excessive number, a one in one out policy is a good way to go. It's a good form of discipline. But anyway, it's only you must decide what is a critical mass of Blu-rays to own. It is a personal decision unique to each person. But anyway, thanks for writing in. You can always write in your questions to slashfilmcast@gmail.com. All right, Devendra, why don't we get to what we've been watching this week? Devendra, you've been watching a few things. Tell us about it.
Yeah, mainly Maniac, the new Netflix series that's entirely directed by Cary Fukunaga and written by Patrick Somerville. And there are a whole bunch of other writers, too. But they're the main creative forces behind the show. And it is pretty wild. Like, just watching the trailers for this can give you a sense of how weird it is. The trailers, you know, you see it stars Jonah Hill and Emma Stone, which also seem like pretty big stars to have in a Netflix series. There seems like there's some VR alternate reality type stuff happening. It's very sci-fi. I'm not going to spoil too much, but I will say I'm just like really digging everything the show is doing. It feels to me like a Satoshi Kon film, like something like Paprika, mixed together with Brazil, with a bit of like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, maybe a bit of Inception in there. There's a lot of like different influences here, but I'm really struck by how much this feels like truly trippy psychedelic anime. So it's set in an alternate reality, New York City, except it feels like modern day. But the tech is kind of all over the place, right? There are chunky 80s style computers with huge monitors and big screens and big keyboards. There are dot matrix printers. But there's also like, you know, there are supercomputers and there's artificial intelligence. A big part of this show, a big character in the show is a giant supercomputer, you know, that expresses emotion through a wall of like LEDs. It's this really wild mixture of old and new tech. But not like, it's not realistic. It feels, I don't know what's the word, like expressionistic. I don't know. Like there's a lot going on, sort of like how Brazil and like Terry Gilliam stuff, you see a lot of wild and wacky inventions. I'm thinking of like the Christoph Waltz thing he did too, whose name I can't remember right now. There's just like so much ingenuity and world building going on. So I'm fascinated by all that. But the show itself is also about, trauma and mental health and trying to move past like the things that are really holding you back in society. And the way virtual reality or alternate reality comes in, there's a sort of simulator that lets you re-experience the worst moments of your life. That's all part of like this whole new treatment thing. There's a lot going on here. It's really weird, I will say that. So I don't know if this show is for everybody, but it's very much for me. Like it really hits everything I love about science fiction and really wild anime. There's a point, Justin Theroux is in this. I believe Patrick Somerville used to write on Leftovers, so he probably dragged him over from there. Justin Theroux is in this show, and at one point he has like a CG giant spiky Goku anime hair thing going on. And, you know, he's like having weird virtual sex with a digital creature that has like a ton of tentacles or something. It's completely within the world of the show. It's just so weird. I've never seen him so like, I don't know, silly is the way. Like he is just, I think the show has a lot of fun with Justin Theroux and his weird and wacky hairstyles and things like that. So hard to explain. I can't really say more unless I start.
What you just
said
was almost completely incomprehensible just now.
Yeah,
but,
just like, just imagine Justin Theroux having like virtual sex with you know, a character from World of Warcraft, and Justin Theroux like fully into it too. Like he's really giving it his all, as you'd say. And it's amazing. Like the show, it feels like it just, I don't know.
How many episodes of this are you in? Like
it's 10 episodes so far. This is basically a mini series. I don't think they're gonna like continue after this. Yeah,
but how many episodes are you into it?
I'm in about 6 episodes at this point.
I see. Okay, so you've watched the majority of it at this point, and
I've watched most of it.
Something you'd recommend?
Yeah, man. Gabriel Byrne is in the show.
Nice.
It's crazy. Gabriel Byrne, like at one point, doing like a weird, bad, like New York gangster accent, which is pretty good. At one point, the show goes kind of episodic and it turns into like a Coen Brothers story set in Long Island. Like it's just all over the place, but I'm loving every minute of it. If you like those references I've mentioned, it's pretty much that. I think you'll enjoy it.
All right. That's Maniac. It's available on Netflix right now. I'm actually really looking forward to checking this one out. It looks so interesting. So,
yeah.
The show's Maniac. Okay. Maniac.
And also, by the way, about Cary Fukunaga, I just want to say, happy to hear that he's potentially doing the next Bond. We'll see what happens with that, because he's left a couple high-profile projects before. I do feel like you can't keep doing that, right? No matter how good you are, you kind of have to go all the way through with one of these things. So I'm hoping we see that movie.
I don't know. I feel like if you've got the talent, which I think Cary Fukunaga definitely does, you know, you can leave however many projects you want, at least
I don't know,
for a limited time. Like,
he just wasted, there's a great article, I believe it was in GQ or something, but he basically burned years of his life, you know, with movies and projects that just didn't happen. So I think now he's like, well, I can't be this young, you know, firebrand forever. I can have to do something. So if it's compromise that he has to do, maybe it'll be Bond, but who knows? Like, well, they couldn't even get the Danny Boyle thing happening.
Let's think of some, and yeah, of course, over time, anyone's juice in Hollywood runs out. Of course, I don't feel like that's the case with Cary Fukunaga yet, but we'll see.
Like Beasts of No Nation, right? We talked about that movie. No Oscar love, really.
Yeah, I mean, when you make a movie that makes, you know, $500 million worldwide, that gives you more options, right?
Gives you juice, yes.
And that might be something that he's interested in doing, because I think those movies, like, generally do pretty well.
Danny Boyle can walk away from that movie and have fewer consequences, whereas I feel like Cary Fukunaga is still waiting for, like, that one big hit moment, because the people who like movies and cinephiles appreciate him, but not many other people yet.
He has not had a widely commercial mainstream hit quite yet, right? And so maybe maybe there's a calculation there. Now, as you pointed out, Danny Boyle left the project, right?
Which, by the way, I can't even, in my mind's eye, I cannot envision what a Danny Boyle James Bond movie would look like, right? Like,
I mean, I can't imagine what a Cary Fukunaga James Bond looks like.
I think it would look a lot like, you know, like Skyfall or something. Like, just his, like, stylistically, right? He is so, like, his visual sensibility is so, like, classical at times. Like, it's not as manic as something, like, you'd expect from Danny Boyle, right? I expect, like, James Bond with, like, a GoPro on his head at some point, or James Bond, like, being shot digitally handheld in ways we've never seen before with Danny Boyle.
Like, chest-mounted camera or something like that, running through a thing. I think the thing is, so first, I actually put a Twitter poll on twitter.com/DaveChensky, and I wrote, today it was announced that Cary Fukunaga was hired to direct the new Bond film. Do you actually think a Bond film directed by Cary Fukunaga will ever be released in theaters? And 53% said yes, 47% said no, out of over 1,000 votes.
It's amazing.
I think that I don't know that this will ever come to pass. I think that, like, the owners of James Bond have really strong opinions on the kinds of movies that James Bond can be in. It is baffling. Like, a few things baffle me about this. One is that James Bond is literally one of the prototypical examples of the concept of formulaic, right? I mean, it is so formulaic that you already, like, people already know all the elements that are in James Bond movies, right? You could name them if you tried, right? Like, there's all, like, every James Bond movie needs to have, like, all these, like, opening action sequence, you know, evil supervillain, tons of one-liners and puns, shaken, not stirred, blah, blah, blah. Now, the Daniel Craig movies, like, kind of upended that in some ways, but
prior to
Craig, it was very, very formulaic. And so it's kind of weird to me that you can't find a director who's willing to get on board with that.
It's more like, we don't know. We don't know what's going on with the producers and everything. I think around the Casino Royale era, they were desperate, because, like, the last Brosnan movies drove the franchise into the ground, and you had, like, you had Bourne, and you had some, like, fresh new, action film franchises and stuff. Like, they needed to evolve. And my main takeaway with the last movie, whose name I can't even remember right now, Spectre. Spectre seemed to go to great lengths to bring Bond to where he was before, right? Like, to set up all the characters where you expect them and just, like, rebuild that old paradigm. And I think that's kind of what held that movie back. And also, it was a complete mess. So
it was much more campy than all the rest of the Daniel Craig movies, right?
Yeah.
And so, so that's one thing. I think that's largely accurate what you're saying about the direction the franchise has taken. But Bond fundamentally has always been an extremely retrograde character, right? Yeah. I mean, he does not fit into today's progressive society, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think I just think you can't have a character named Pussy Galore anymore. Like, it's been parodied to death.
Perhaps
and,
not. Yes.
And so it's just hard to know which directions to take this franchise in, because fundamentally, unless he evolves significantly in ways that feel organic, that feel logical, it's not gonna be an interesting franchise to follow. So right. I am curious what take Cary Fukunaga has on this character, and I am also very dubious that we'll actually see.
Sure.
That take.
I'm most interested in what set pieces, you know, Cary Fukunaga would bring to this franchise, right? I'm thinking of this, like, you know, giving the way Macquarie approaches Mission Impossible
right.
at this point. Like, if he has great ideas in terms of what he can do with this character, I'm down for that, even if, like, they don't completely fix everything that's wrong with Bond. Like, how do you do Bond in the Me Too moment? I don't know. It's that's tough. And I believe they're still, like, working, you know, it's still the same writers as usual, right? Purvis and Wade. So, who
just
knows?
Just think of the stuff Cary Fukunaga did for True Detective Season 1. You know,
yeah.
Like, that drug raid sequence. You know,
yep.
Imagine something like that for Bond.
All-time great.
Yep, like, all-time great shots in all of TV history. So, I think it would be awesome if it ever came to pass.
It would be awesome.
Would
and
be
also,
awesome.
Like, between Casino Royale and Skyfall, like, Sam Mendes, like, this, say what you... I know a lot of people aren't huge fans of Skyfall, but that movie has some great, fantastic set pieces. And
it's beautiful.
That's kind of it.
Didn't Roger Deakins do Skyfall?
Movie. I believe so.
It's worth watching just for Roger Deakins alone, you know?
So I feel like Cary Fukunaga, looking at that, looking at Sam Mendes kind of not being able to match that with Spectre, and saying, you know, okay, how can I do better than that? And I'm excited for something like that.
All right. That's what Devendra's been watching. Maniac by Cary Fukunaga. Great director. Can't wait to see what he does next. Maybe it'll be Bond.
Mm-hmm.
I watched a few things this week, Devendra. I watched Upgrade, newest film by director Lee Whannell.
Nice.
Part half yeah. of the Saw franchise starters. Like, he was one of the people in Saw, and since then he and James Wan have gone in their own different directions.
He was one of the writers, right, too.
Correct. Writer and actor, and, you know, that movie franchise went on to make, like, I don't know, half a billion, many billions of dollars at the box office. Upgrade. Interesting movie. I'll read the plot summary from IMDb real quick. And this movie is set in the near future where technology controls nearly all aspects of life. But when Gray, a self-identified technophobe, has his world turned upside down, his only hope for revenge is an experimental computer chip implant called STEM.
His only hope is technology.
His
Who
only hope
this
is
coming.
Ooh, so ironic.
Yeah.
So this movie is a lot of fun, I have to say.
I loved it.
It is a great B movie, in my opinion. And it reminds me of, like, B movies from, like, the 80s and 90s. Like, you remember there was a company called, like, Artisan Entertainment? You remember that company?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And they would release all these, like, really kind of relatively low budget kind of B movie horror genre movies, and I watched, like, a ton of those movies when I was younger, and so yeah, it reminded me kind of like a movie they would make, where it's a little bit too cheesy to be taken seriously, but
right.
it is still a ton of fun, and it
and
actually
you can feel the budget too at times. Like, it's trying to paint this future world, but they can't really, aside from, like, one future looking car. That's pretty much it. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, I actually listened to the commentary, which is I would recommend to anyone, mm-hmm. because Lee Whannell gives good commentary.
This is a blind buy, by the way. I feel like if you listen to us and you know our action movie sensibilities, I think anybody will appreciate this movie.
Yeah. I mean, I would say it's a blind buy if you're into kind of cheesy genre, like sci-fi, you know, horror movies, right? Like,
but mainly for that commentary, too.
The commentary is very good. It is very funny. He's very self-deprecating. He gives actually practical advice about how to make a low-budget short film and make it seem big.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was hilarious. Like, something he said that was really interesting is, it is very interesting what the audience is willing to forgive, right? Because there's things that he thought, like, oh my gosh, like, they're going to notice that so-and-so has a fake beard at some point in the movie, right? Like, so-and-so has a fake beard, and he's like, everyone's going to notice that. Like, that's it's a huge, you know, sore spot of this movie is this guy has a fake beard. It's so obvious. No one gives a crap about the fake beard. Like, the movie comes out, no one gives a crap about the fake beard, and it's like, all that matters is that people are engrossed in the story, like that they right. care about what the characters are doing, that they want to see what direction this plot is taking. And if they are, they'll forgive a lot about the look of the film and the feel of the film. And I think that largely happens here. Another piece of advice he gave that I thought was pretty interesting was there's basically a billionaire character in Upgrade, and the mm-hmm. protagonist goes to visit his house. And it is in this like spectacular vista, like nature. I think it's filmed in Australia. And
yeah.
he was saying how if you have a low budget movie, let nature be your production designer, right? Like basically choose a spot that looks spectacular outside and
yeah, have characters walk down a hole and cut to, you know, interiors and warehouses.
Yeah, you know, have this spectacular vista. They go down a hole and then cut to like a set, you know, and then it looks like wow, that's amazing. The commentary is great, very funny. He's a funny guy. And the movie is a ton of fun as well. It actually has kind of interesting ideas about where sci-fi is going to take us, mm-hmm. right? And it has memorable action sequences, which is pretty impressive considering it's a low budget movie.
Yeah. Memorable action also, it edges a little into too gory at times, but I feel like that is very true to the B movie roots, right?
Yeah,
watching
exactly.
This felt like watching Mad Max for the first time for me.
This is my favorite performance from Logan Marshall Green, who has typically been known as a poor man's Tom Hardy.
Right.
I think he does a great job here. And there is
in a movie that looks like a poor man's Venom, basically.
Yeah.
Kind of sad.
The plot is extremely shockingly similar to Venom. And so it is interesting to see how similar both the actor and the plot is. But Logan Marshall Green, something that the director talked about in the commentary was how much work – like I'm really going to try to stay away from spoilers, but I'll say mm-hmm. that like the actor, Logan Marshall Green, put a lot of work into separating his facial expression from what his body was doing, right? And that's all I'll say. And that work really pays off in the film because I think that's difficult to do. What that character is doing in this film, what that actor is doing in this film, is challenging. And I think Logan Marshall Green, I'm messing up his name. Logan Marshall Green nails it. So I recommend this movie. I think it's a lot of fun and is very well directed. They do a lot with very little. The movie's called Upgrade. It's available right now on video on demand. I bought it on Blu-ray. Check it out if you have a chance.
Check it out. I have to say, for the action, I really enjoyed the camera movements.
Yeah.
Too. I feel like that really sold when they couldn't have like a huge, large-scale fight or something or tons of choreography. Just the way the camera moves at times with the action felt really impactful. It just felt like it made it all more kinetic. This isn't The Raid, but sometimes you feel like it is.
The camera is doing some really interesting stuff in this movie. So it's a movie worth checking out. So that is Upgrade. All right, let's move on to the next thing I've been watching. But before we do that, we have a special guest joining us today, normal co-host Jeff Cannata. Jeff, how you doing, man?
It's normal, dude. So normal. Just so normal. Doing my normal thing.
We talked earlier, Jeff, about how you're taking care of both your kids today, which I've heard tell from people who have two kids that it is like exponentially more complex to do that.
It is, but that is not actually accurate. The truth is, my wife is away on a business trip, and my son, who had just turned two, is having his first sleepover at grandma and grandpa's house.
Ooh.
So he's actually not even here. I am just alone with the 5-month-old, who is a handful all by herself and has been having some sleep regression, and she started teething a bit. So she's her sleep has been fitful at best. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't want to subject you guys to me having to run to the other room as she screamed. And then I had to resettle her, et cetera, et cetera. So I think she's down. I don't want to jinx anything, but I think she is down for the moment. So I'm here. I'm here being normal.
I think what we're trying to say right now is that literally at any moment, Jeff could be taken away from us and not rejoin the podcast, right? I mean, yes. I think that's definitely going to happen, possibly. There, so
potential screaming in the other room to which I must attend.
Yeah. So just know that we're grateful for any minutes with Jeff Cannata we have. but also, if you love something, let it go. You know what I'm saying? And by that, something I mean time with Jeff Cannata. So
my real message to everyone is don't have kids and apologies to Devendra.
Yeah.
I'm ready. I've seen Matt Singer's slow degradation to madness as well. Yeah. I'm ready. Happy to join the club, guys.
Well, speaking of things that help you have kids, romantic comedies, guys. I had a chance to watch Set It Up, the Netflix romantic comedy. And I don't usually like to watch romantic comedies. It's not typically my thing. But this movie is a great example of one. Yes?
Dave likes to watch tragic comedies.
That's right. I like to – not even comedies, Jeff, just extremely sad films. Set It Up is a great example of a competently executed romantic comedy. It's very funny, and it takes a good amount of skill to be able to kind of pull off the dialogue and personality of the characters in a romantic comedy. It takes a lot of skill to pull that off well. And I think these actors do a great job. Specifically, Zoe Deutsch and Glenn Powell play the protagonists in this film. And they are delightful. I think they're, you know, I think those are great actors. I think the characters they play are don't have many characteristics other than that they are witty and humorous. But Set It Up, if you want, you know, something light, something fun, you could do a lot worse than watching this on Netflix. So that's Set It Up, and it's available on Netflix right now. And finally, I wanted to just mention that I have completed the Spider-Man game for PlayStation 4, Marvel Spider-Man.
Congrats on your accomplishment.
I don't usually, you know, complete that many games in a year because I just don't have that much time. But this is one that was so insanely fun that I had to finish it. And I just wanted to mention two things real quick. First of all, I actually agree with Jeff Cannata's perspective on this, that the storyline in this game is a better Spider-Man story than Spider-Man Homecoming, in my opinion. Like, and when I say better, I mean truer to the essence of the character, in my opinion, right? At least
I think the best Spider-Man film is a video game.
Yeah. I mean, it's very, very good. And they nail the swinging mechanics, like, you know, swinging around the city and getting from place to place. Usually you, like, if you play a game like Grand Theft Auto or whatever that's open world, you want to fast travel to places. But it is so much fun to swing from place to place in this game that you just want to do it to take the scenic run most of the time. So anyway, really love the game. And I finished the 20-hour campaign in about like 10 days. So I was a big fan of the game. And a big fan of the music of the game too, which I thought was heavily inspired by Danny Elfman's score for the Sam Raimi Spider-Man films. And it got me so into the mood of those movies that I actually went back and watched Raimi's Spider-Man 2, which is my favorite one of those movies. And in my opinion, that movie still holds up. I still love that movie. A lot of the special effects, you know, some of the special effects are a little dated, but like overall, I think they pull it off. The idea of having this guy, Alfred Molina, play Dr. Octopus and having eight limbs and moving from place to place, like the physicality of that character, the look of it.
Set pieces in that movie,
Spider-Man 1 had decent action scenes, but Spider-Man 2 takes it to a whole other level. The bank robbery sequence, the train sequence.
I just like the whole fight, the thing like where he sees the reflection of a car being thrown at the restaurant from Mary Jane's eyes, and like that sets up that whole fight. Like that whole thing is insane. And well, then the midair fight.
It's a great action scene, but also makes no sense. Like what was Dr. Octopus's plan in Spider-Man 2? Like he's
trying to say, "Hey, what's up, Spider-Man? I'm here."
Well, first of all, he didn't know that was Spider-Man. He thought that was Peter Parker, Spider-Man's friend. Yeah. So he threw a car at Peter Parker to get his attention. But what if Peter Parker wasn't Spider? Dude would have been killed by a car. You know, anyway, it makes no sense.
He's not Spider-Man. There you go.
That's an octo-oops is what they call that.
Yeah, an octo-oops.
There's a wonderful moment in the video game that references the train scene from Spider-Man 2.
Yeah.
As if it is canon for the video game.
It is delightful.
Which is really great.
It is delightful, yes.
I happen to really vehemently dislike that train sequence from that movie, but I understand people have a soft spot in their heart for it. I will take the Otto Octavius from the video game over Alfred Molina's Otto Octavius any day of the week, but I understand your enthusiasm as well.
I think they're both great. And but, you know, putting aside the action scenes, I love that Spider-Man 2 is about identity. It's about this character grappling with who he is, who he should be, and whether or not he's willing to make the sacrifice to be the hero that Gotham, you know, New York City needs. And so I think it's still a brilliant superhero films, one of the best ones. And I would say the tone, the music, the feel of Spider-Man 2 is very similar in a lot of ways to the Spider-Man game. It's probably the biggest, I would say the biggest direct inspiration is from the film, is my read on it. But they're both awesome.
And you know, you brought up the music in the video game, and it's worth, I think, underscoring just how wonderful all of the sound design is of the video game. The music not only is excellent, but it also comes in at just the right moments. It swells as you swing through the city. At every time you leap into the air, it lifts you. You know, it is really well orchestrated and scored to the action that you are actually performing in the game. And they do a lot of really clever things too with all of the dialogue. There's a lot of storytelling as you're progressing through the city. It's not just cutscenes, although there are a lot of those as well. It's also storytelling as you're playing, as you're swinging through the city. And they actually recorded all the dialogue multiple times to dynamically switch between if you are standing still as Spider-Man or swinging. So the actor who played Spider-Man recorded his lines sort of out of breath, as if he was strenuously swinging through the city, so that it made sense. So it didn't sound like he was just this calm guy. But then, you know, not knowing if the player was listening to the cutscene just standing still or perched on top of a building, they also recorded it calmly. So the game actually dynamically switches out so it all sounds right. And those subtle things go such a long way in making it all feel like it's actually happening.
Agreed. A lot of nice little subtle touches that make the game extremely immersive. Strongly recommend the game Marvel Spider-Man for PS4, and also recommend the film Spider-Man 2 as well.
By the way, just briefly, while we're on the topic of games, I want to say shout out to all the folks from Telltale. That is a sad, sad story. They've made some of my favorite narrative games over the past few years. That first Walking Dead is one of my favorite games of all time, and I was really excited to, you know, see where things were going with this season. That is just a sad story. Hopefully, all those folks can land somewhere good.
Yeah, I talked about this at length on my video game podcast, but at the risk of getting on a soapbox, it really underscores the need for unionization in the gaming industry. They are just absolutely – people are just chewed up and spit out and discarded like they're worthless. And it's a travesty, and it needs to be addressed.
It's rough. And I'm hearing, by the way, similar complaints from the VFX industry after all these superhero movies and everything. It's crazy out there. Support your workers, please.
Yes, that is absolutely something I've heard as well from friends in the VFX industry.
Before I get to our review of Mandy, we got to thank all the people who donated to the podcast this week. Thanks so much to Nico from Vienna, Austria, Justin L. from Minneapolis, Minnesota, and Josh Calkin from Houston, Texas for their contributions. Thanks also to new subscribers, Raphael Jovine, Aaron Linsky, and Ryan Robertson. You can always donate to the show by going to paypal.me/filmcast. That's paypal.me/filmcast. Or go to slashfilm.com, use the /filmcast tab, click on the PayPal links on the side of the page. All the money you donate does go to help us defray the cost of seeing films and putting on the show for you. We appreciate any money that you can donate to us, but we also do not want you to donate if it causes any hardship whatsoever for your life. Your listenership and your recommendation of the podcast is more than enough. So thanks to all of our donors this week. Let's get to our review of Mandy.
Crimson, primordial sky, the wretched warlock reached into the dark embrace. His fist closed around the serpent's eye. Strange, and eternal. I need you to get me that girl I saw. You know what to do.
That was from the trailer for Mandy, the new film by writer-director Panos Cosmatos, who wrote this film with Aaron Stewart on. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. Mandy is set in the primal wilderness of 1983, where Red Miller, a broken and haunted man, hunts an unhinged religious sect who slaughtered the love of his life. So that is the premise of this movie, and it stars Nicolas Cage and Andrea Riseborough as Red and Mandy. And, you know, the person whose opinion of this movie I was most interested in was Jeff Cannata, because this movie... It's not.
I feel like it was made for Jeff. It was totally made for Jeff.
Don't start with me, guys. Do not start with me.
It's not a normal film. It's not a normal film, guys. You know, it's.
And I'm a normal host, so we've established.
I mean, Devendra Harder. I thought it was. I will say that I wanted to see Mandy, but that this was a decision to review this was largely driven by Devendra Harder, right?
And, I thought this was going to, by the way, guys, I thought not, you know, I don't watch trailers or anything, but I thought this was going to be the movie adaptation of the hit Barry Manilow song.
Mm. I mean, I feel like it could score this movie at times.
So you can imagine my surprise.
All right. Well, I thought it was really telling when I asked Devendra, you know, weeks ago, hey, should I blind buy this this movie? And you could not wholeheartedly recommend I blind buy it, which is something that you typically are okay recommending. I mean, you did it with Upgrade earlier this episode.
Yeah, but Upgrade, I think, is widely, you know, it's something a lot of people
accessible.
Can enjoy.
It's more accessible, yeah. Right, than this movie. Right, so
I try to cater to, you know, people's tastes, and I know what you guys like, you know, so I know this was a tough sell. So I'm glad we're still able to review it.
So Devendra, tell us why you were so intent on recommending this film.
This movie is insane. Guys, like, insane in the best ways, though. Like, I will be honest, I'm not sure if you guys have seen Panos Cosmatos's first movie, Beyond the Black Rainbow. That movie has its fans. I am not one of them. I absolutely hate that movie. And I can understand why, you know, you may not like this one. But I saw it a couple weeks ago with my wife, and I was just astounded by, like, what's going on in this movie. Because half of it, I think, is a really nice and quiet love story of these two people who've carved out this little life for themselves, you know, in the wilderness away from people. And it's like very lovely. It's very tender. And I think this is this movie encapsulates everything Nicolas Cage does well. It gets like some tender aspects of him as a loving, you know, husband who, you know, maybe he's not. He's basically what, a lumberjack out in the wilderness. Like, you know, he's not. I don't think there's like much going on with this guy's life aside from this little cabin he has with his lovely wife. But
truck is rad.
I feel like he really sold this like nice quiet existence. Like there's something to that, and maybe that's just living in New York and wanting to run away at some point to like a nice quiet cabin. I really enjoyed the first half of this movie, and then things ramp up, and then it turns into like the most Nicolas Cage of Nicolas Cagey, you know, crazy action movies, where his like insane gonzo acting style is on full, like on full display. And I was astounded that one movie could really capture both of those elements of the national treasure that is Nicolas Cage. And I think the movie too, like it's I think it's a tender love story. I think it's a great revenge story. There are some sequences in here that I'll never forget. Stylistically, it's astounding. The soundtrack is incredible. And I also think, like, weirdly, this movie has, I think, a lot to say about like shitty men. And I did not expect that here. And this movie has like a wonderful sequence where, you know, a shitty guy who thinks he's, you know, the king of the world gets taken down in the simplest ways. And I found that to be pretty beautiful too. So yeah, I love a lot of aspects of this movie.
All right. Well, that's Devendra's thoughts on Mandy. And here's what I'm going to say about Panos Cosmatos' other movie, Beyond the Black Rainbow. I may or may not have a friend who lives in a state where marijuana is legal, right?
Yeah.
And this friend of mine,
It's okay, Dave. It's okay.
You're talking about Bluff? Cool.
This friend of mine may or may not.
His name is Blave. Yes.
Blave? Blave Blen?
This friend of mine may or may not have, on multiple occasions, gotten extremely high and watched Panos Cosmatos Beyond the Black Rainbow on Netflix.
First of all, I have to say, I've known this Blave for many times. I wanna see Blave get very high and watch Beyond the Black Rainbow. More but like maybe Blaze, we'll have to schedule that at some point. Yeah.
What'd you say, Jeff?
More like Blaze, am I right?
Yeah, nice. Well done. I mean, I can neither confirm nor deny that this person's name is Blave. But I will say that I think there are movies that lend themselves to enjoying while under the influence of
I think that's a good way for because first of all because it's a tough movie to enjoy if you're not under the influence of something, but maybe it does like unlock another aspect of understanding for whatever Panos is going for.
I'm just being completely speculative because this is my friend talking, not me, you know, like this is just what my friend has told me about his experiences watching Beyond the Black Rainbow. But Mandy is very similar in style to Beyond the Black Rainbow. Like lots of extremely protracted sequences where like nothing is happening except like colors flashing at the screen, you know?
But a lot is happening. Come on.
Yeah, sure. And like very like slow and repetitive dialogue, you know, that takes place over, you know, the movie could be, there's probably like, I don't know, 30 lines in the entire film, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's just very, very slow.
Including,
and very
you ripped my
and
shirt. Yeah.
Every character talks like this!
But you see, Jeff, when you did that, I was there. I was hanging on everywhere. It's like, what is Jeff talking about? He's got me here.
Jeff,
neither of you guys went to acting school.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
Where I would say a good 80% of the student projects I sat through were that. Because the acting happens in the pauses. It's very hard to stomach.
So what do you think of the film, Jeff?
In the words of Devendra Hardwar, this movie has its fans. I am not one of them. I do not think this is a bad movie. I think this movie absolutely nails what it's going for. It just happens to be the fact that what it's going for is something I have absolutely no desire to watch. Mm. it's doing what it's doing, and it knows what it wants, and it goes for it, and it achieves what it wants, and I find it an absolute waste of my time. So that's nothing against the movie per se. It's just a comment on my taste, and I can only speak from my taste. And I don't even really admire what this movie is going for. Some movies I'm like, I didn't really enjoy that, but I admire the swing. I don't even admire the swing. I think this is masturbatory and tedious and ultimately about nothing. Like I don't know. Are we doing a spoiler section?
Yeah, let's do a spoiler section.
I'll be more detailed in what I'm talking about there, but I will say, it is very dark. I mean, dark isn't even a strong enough word. I don't know what a stronger word would be. It's
pitch black.
It's macabre. You know, it is. It's demented in a lot of ways. And I tend to not really enjoy that. I can put myself through stuff like that if and I've said this before on the show. But if there seems to be a point on the other side of it, and boy, I couldn't discern one. It's not even style over substance, because I didn't even admire the style in particular. And again, it's just not for me. You know, this is just not a movie for me. I appreciate that people like it. I talked to several other of my friends who were like, oh, I loved it. I watched it twice. And I'm like, how could you do that to yourself? But clearly it's just one of those ones that I'm just not on the same wavelength with. And, I had this not been a movie we were going to talk about, I would have turned it off much earlier than even the turn the movie takes.
I will say, though, by the way, this is a movie. It is available on video on demand, in limited release in some theaters. If you have the power to turn this movie off, I think that, you know, that's probably not the way to watch it. You need to be trapped in a theater with a bunch of other people going through this experience.
Yeah.
You have to and be trapped in order to enjoy this
you're
movie.
Really selling it, DeVigure. You're really selling it.
That's but this is the thing. If you're sitting at home and like your phone is within reach, like anything that can distract you from whatever spell the movie is putting on, like it's a tough movie to watch at home, basically.
Find the heaviest thing in your house and then put it on top of you.
Oh, weighted blankets. Yeah. That sounds good.
And then throw the remote control across the room so that you can't physically get to it anymore.
And keep your phone out of the room too.
Yeah.
It's a phone.
But then really how do you get help to get the thing that's heavier moved later, you know?
I mean, by the time
the movie's
over.
It's a problem for future Jeff. Yeah.
By the time the movie's over, you'll have given up all hope. So there's no need to worry about it. I'm glad. I don't know, Dave, what did you think of it?
I thought it was interesting. You know, I thought it was interesting. I will say it is an experience.
It is
an immersive experience. You know, like, we talk about things that, whether something should be a film, you know, there's many things that don't need to be a film. A movie I directed called The Primary Instinct didn't necessarily need to be a film, you know, like didn't necessarily make use of like every conceivable aspect of film. I obviously love the little movie I made with Steven, but
I feel like we're getting like little dark confessionals now.
No. I mean, it's just like
maybe the world didn't need this. I don't know.
No, it's not that it didn't need it. It's just like we did not make maximum usage of the cinematic medium, right?
Right.
And this is a movie that makes maximum usage of the cinematic medium. Like, this is not a movie that could be a podcast. Do you know what I mean? This is not a movie that could be a book.
I would love the podcast of this movie. Oh my god!
I actually would love that. Honestly, the spoken word version of Bandy, just like chainsaws for 30 minutes. Like,
it's a movie that like really takes advantage of every, you know, the sound, the visuals, the acting, the performances,
everything is turned to like 11 in this movie. But I have to say, the reason I really admire it, stylistically, it's fantastic. But come on, guys, like. We love certain Nicolas Cage movies, right? And I think there are a lot of movies where maybe they don't really take advantage of what he does. There was a really revealing interview with him about like a lot of his recent movies have been basically VOD films, like things he's just making to make the paycheck, and he's fine.
This is the movie that Nicolas Cage always thinks he's making.
Yes,
and for the first time. The filmmaker is also on the same page. It's like Nicolas Cage has been making this movie over and over again.
This is what's been going on in his head. Yeah.
Here's what the people were in on it, you know?
I mean, here's what else I'll say about this movie is you do have a Nicolas Cage performance where he is going full Cage here, right? And so
I don't agree with that. I don't think he's full Cage. I don't think I was actually impressed with how restrained he was for most of it.
Well, it's kind of both, right? It is both. Dark. It is like the Cage from Adaptation, and it is the Cage from like give me something here.
Well, here's what I was gonna say. Right? You know, Face Off or something. But here's what I was gonna say is if you want to see Nicolas Cage going full Cage, but you don't want a kind of very plodding, deliberately paced movie that's more like impressionistic than it is plot driven. I would recommend Mom and Dad, the horror movie that he recently starred in last year. Like, that is
that's also very good. Yeah.
That movie moves really quickly. It's insane. It has Nicolas Cage going crazy. And I think that is going to be a lot more. It's not as remarkable as this movie. I mean, this movie is a remarkable, like, it's not many movies get made like this. This is a very unique looking, unique sounding, unique feeling movie. And I think Jeff puts it really well when he says, like, it's basically an acquired taste. It's basically not a movie that's for everyone. If it is your thing, it's going to be really, really your thing. I mean, this movie has, what, 90 7% on Rotten Tomatoes or something like that. Like,
this which is astounding, by the way.
A lot
it's
of
astounding
critics.
Astounding that a movie like this, yeah.
I think it's an I think it's an indictment of movie critics,
oh,
sadly.
Come on, Jeff.
I do.
93%, by the way, just so people know. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm sorry to say this, but I do think that that is a reflection of just how starved so many movie critics are for anything that tastes different. You know, it's just it's unique and different. And so, yes, finally, something that's trying something.
I don't think it's that, though, because like there have been a lot of like weird experimental movies like this, and they don't always they don't get the same amount of love. I think there is something unique happening here. Like, Jeff, you one thing you mentioned in talking about this movie is that it's about nothing. And that is I don't think that's true. I think it is certainly there's a lot going on here. This is one of the most tender love stories, you know, we've seen starring Nicolas Cage. And then it turns full tilt into something else. But I think there is value like there. It is a prototypical love story and then revenge story. But in between the lines, there's also a lot going on here with a crazy religious cult and the, you know, the reflections on America today. Like it's there. It's certainly there.
Jeff, I object to your characterization, you know, of like the critical consensus. I think this is a movie that feels a lot like a movie that like Jodorowsky would make or, Tarkovsky, you know, and I think there's something brilliant about those directors' movies. And I think there's something brilliant about this movie, but I agree with you that it's not for everyone. You know, it's an acquired taste. I don't think it's super accessible. I don't know of a single person outside of film Twitter that I'd recommend this movie to. You know, so like
It's tough.
It's So it's just not a movie for everyone. But anyway,
it's not just film Twitter too. Like, you know, you may have friends who like. Did you grow up watching Hellraiser? Are you into those sorts of weird things? Like,
I don't think it's as accessible as Hellraiser. You know, like
it is certainly not. Yeah. It is certainly not as accessible as Hellraiser. But also, I think
there's a lot of Hellraiser in this movie. Just
it's an important distinction to make, though, because it could sound to some like we're talking about a level of sophistication of the palette that is required. And I don't think that's the case. I don't think you need a sophisticated palette to understand or to appreciate this movie, to like this movie. I think you just have to be into a certain kind of experience.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
And also worth experiencing, too. Like, the reason I'm recommending as well, one of the final Johan Johansson scores. And what an amazing rock opera score it is. Like, this movie, it feels like, you know, when I go see, like, a play or something on stage, you never know how good it's going to be. It's not like they have the same performance every night. It could be a stand-in. It could be a play that hasn't been reviewed yet, right? It feels like taking a gamble like that, but the overall experience is sometimes more worth it than, you know, the actual narrative or something, right?
All right, guys, why don't we get the spoilers for Mandy starting right now?
Now you're looking for the secret.
Trying to see this coming.
No.
But you won't find it because, of course,
you're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret now.
You want to be fooled.
But the one moment, right, the turning point of this movie is the point where they drug Mandy, right? And the guy is just like really the religious cult leader played by Lannis Roach, who I loved, is really like selling himself, right? As he's delivering this monologue completely naked and she just laughs at him. And I thought, like, how remarkable is that in a movie like this? Like, her one response, and that's her moment of power, even though it'll ultimately get her killed, that is her response, and that's enough to make, you know, him call her a whore and worthless. Yeah.
Well, when I saw this movie, I tweeted the following. I tweeted the following quote, which is, quote, "At core, men are afraid women will laugh at them, while at core, women are afraid men will kill them," end quote.
Exactly.
And I thought that dynamic where she can basically reduce this character to nothing just by laughing at him was very potent. And of course, she is punished for that. But
thereby destroying the power he has over this, you know, this tiny cult around him too, because they start laughing. And like, it's just all, I don't know. I found that incredibly telling. Yeah.
So I think I understood most of what happened in this film with one exception, which is when he goes to visit that guy with the tiger.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know what I had no idea
who
what
is
was
that
going
dude.
On. Yeah, who is that guy?
Who is that guy?
Like, what's going
dude
on
tells
with the
him
tiger?
Where to go. The dude is, you know, he's a seer of sorts. He's telling him where to find the bad people. Like at that point, right? The movie goes from being this like yeah impressionistic, lovely little love story to
you
something.
Keep saying that, and I did not get love story from. From
you spend an hour with them just like hanging out on a couch, like in bed. Like,
yeah, that's not really
bed.
A love story, though. That's more like love no. hanging out with people.
It's not even.
I'm not talking about what you guys are doing with them. I'm just saying, like, okay, I don't know. Maybe your relationships are a little more exciting. But to me, I think true love, right, is it does feel like somebody you could just. Have this like quiet little life with somebody who's always there to watch movies with you, you know, somebody who you can have these seemingly profound conversations about nothing. To me, that is true love.
Those birds with a crowbar, you know, sure. romantic stuff.
But those are the stories, you know, those stories that you wouldn't tell anybody else. Those are the stories you share with each other. So yes, this is not Before Sunset. This is not a romantic comedy. But to me, I find a certain sort of romance in that. There is like an intimacy you're seeing with these characters.
There is an intimacy. I will 100% agree. There is
go.
Intimacy. But there is no love story. There's no. I know nothing about her, and I know nothing about him. I know nothing about what connects them or brought them together. There's no story of their love. There is an intimate moment where she tells a horrific, repulsive tale. And he hugs her afterwards, which is a tender, sweet, intimate moment. But I didn't get a love story that turns into a revenge tale. I got two people, something transcendently horrific happens to one of them. That it is just mind-numbingly awful. And yes. So he proceeds to do awful things in return, to which he has – almost zero impediment. There is no challenge to what he does. There is no almost not doing it. There is no needing to find a way. He just proceeds to do it. And it happens very matter-of-factly. It's plays out like a series of boss fights in a video game, except there's only very loose association. We've only just seen these people. And so now I guess he has to kill them because we saw them. There's only one or two of them that actually did anything in the movie at all. Others are just window dressing that he slaughters because they happen to be around at the time. It is stripped away. Yes. And I understand that was the point, is stripping the movie away or all of the everything away that isn't essential to mood. But in doing so, I think I lost any desire to participate. Like, I'm not here just to be in your mood, bro. I get it. I get that's what you're doing. But I understood your mood 15 minutes in. I don't need to live in that for two fucking hours. And I don't know.
If you check out of this movie, then yeah, it's tough to enjoy at least something like this that's trying. Like I said, his first movie, I don't enjoy on any level. It's super stylish, but super plotting and doesn't ultimately lead to anything. I just think there's a lot more going on here. Like, I find that intimacy very revealing. I think there is more going on with the like.
What was the theme that resonated most with you? Like, when you come away from this film, what is the thing that you're like, oh man, this movie really taught me a lot about X, or it made me think about Y. Like, what is the thing? Because I'm kind of with Jeff on this one. Like, here's what I like about this movie is obviously the style. I also think it's kind of, you know, at one point she's like reading from this what I assume is a fake fantasy book. Mm-hmm. Is that right? I don't know if it's a real one. Yep. I apologize for any fantasy nerds out there I've offended. But I used to be a little bit into fantasy when I was younger, and this movie in many ways feels like it's trying to kind of be a fantasy, right? Like,
it certainly turned, like, by the end where you're seeing the vistas of like what the wilderness looks like, and it's like something out of Lord of the Rings.
Right. There's moments that are literally animated to drive that point home. And I do think, like, oh hey, if you had a fantasy novel and compress it into 2-hour time period and stripped out like 90% of the dialogue and descriptions, and replaced it instead with, you know, static shots or, you know, push in shots or whatever, you'd get something like this movie. And so I appreciate that it's trying to kind of take these archetypes and bring them to life in an interesting way. But I don't know that I particularly came away from the movie feeling like it had a lot to say about America. Like I said, I think that moment between the two of them when she laughs at him and strips away his power, like that was probably the most interesting part of the movie. Everything else from a plot perspective feels very much like stuff we've seen before in revenge fantasies. So what was the stuff that resonated with you most specifically?
To me, this feels like the apex of revenge fantasies, right? Because to really make a revenge story feel meaningful, you have to be invested in the stakes. So, okay, maybe we spent too long with them just sitting and hanging out in their cabin. But after a while, like I kind of appreciated like what the lives we were seeing on screen, right? I liked the intimacy and what they were going for as characters. These are two people who are just stuck in the middle of nowhere. They're not like saying, man, I wish I was in the city. I wish I was somewhere else. They're happy where they are, and they're so happy. Like,
well, he does
happy
say, maybe we should get out of here.
Yeah,
we should
and
leave
she's like,
place.
No. And she's like, no. Like, she is happy there. And it seems like I think the most interesting thing about him, too, is that he is, you know, it feels like a love there between them. You guys didn't feel that. I just appreciate that intimacy. This whole idea of this cult coming in and a guy thinking the world owes him everything feels, you know, very reminiscent of so many like religious zealots today and, you know, heightened male misogyny and, you know, the patriarchy in general of men who think the world owes them everything because they're so freaking great. Yeah, like it's all those elements coalescing into one thing. And then beyond that.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
But beyond that, like it's not just that. Like it is ends up being like this pure revenge fantasy in a way that I found really compelling, right? After Mandy dies, you know, there's an extended sequence where we see Nicolas Cage just like crying in a bathroom, like a tiny bathroom set. And it goes from being like something that's kind of funny and hilarious to like, I don't know. I actually kind of felt like him showing his grief in a way. And there's a point where his character switches from grief mode into I'm going to fuck shit up mode. And like, I don't know. I appreciate all those aspects of it. To me, this is like the height of what a revenge fantasy could be.
I guess I don't doubt that the Jeremiah Sand character is a stand-in for the patriarchy and that this movie kind of wants to destroy it. And this movie is all for like destroying the patriarchy.
And also the women who support him because, you know, even though it's not great for them and they're literally in sexual slavery, you know, it works out for them in other ways, I guess. Yeah.
But I guess I just, you know, I feel like other movies do a better job of destroying the patriarchy than just literally, I'm going to take a chainsaw to this guy. You know, like that's essentially
but
what.
But has any other movie destroyed the patriarchy with a chainsaw and chainsaw battle? Tell me that, sir.
It has not, Devendra. I will give you that.
The action sequences aren't even fun. Like the chainsaw and chainsaw battle is the one where it's like, okay, well, at least this one's a good idea.
Yeah.
But even that, it's pretty boringly executed. It's not fun or inventive.
I gotta disagree with
this
you
guy,
there.
This guy has a longer chainsaw, which yeah. I guess is a dick thing. I don't know.
He has a longer chainsaw, yeah.
I disagree with you there. I actually really like that sequence. But yeah, I mean, I think
there's a whole bunch. The one where like the other like Hellraiser dude is just like sitting on a couch, like masturbating with his knife dick, and that whole extended sequence of trying to kill him, I found to be kind of hilarious. Like, I think this movie gives you a certain amount of leeway to, like, also laugh at certain points, too. Like, there's the Cheddar Goblin thing that happens in the middle for no reason. And just, like, it is something that happens almost directly in the middle of the movie, right? And this weird 80s commercial that's just, like, reminding you of, like, oh, of all that weird nostalgic crap that we were kind of spoon-fed as kids, in a way. But what a weird distraction from the rest of the movie. It kind of reminds you like, hey, by the way, this is some funny shit as well, even though this is a crazy revenge story. I don't know. For me, guys, this is a mixture of a lot of things that I think when done badly can really make me roll my eyes. And I think a dumb revenge story can be, you know, super exploitive and not very interesting. I just feel like this movie does so many different things right that it really works.
Where I think this movie could be interesting is if you look at it as a origin story for, well, it's him becoming one of those biker dudes. Is Nicolas Cage becoming one of the things that he kills?
Maybe that's a future. Maybe that's like a Conan-esque ending. You know, you are what you kill.
A prequel to Ghost Rider starring Nicolas Cage. That could be too.
Or a prequel to Drag Me. What was it Drag Me Out of Hell? Or was it
Drag
called
Me to Drag Hell? Me yeah. Hell,
which starts with him driving out of hell. Which also, man, I wish that movie was this one. Is this one? I don't know.
I did not have any fun with this movie. I wish that I felt the way you did and do and saw the things in it that you see. I resent this movie for the things it put me through for no reason. Everything, you know, I think about a first revenge movie that pops into my head is Kill Bill, right? And you have a series of really cool action sequences. You have different milieus that, you know, basically set out a series of challenges that our heroine has to overcome. She has to dig deep and figure out how she's going to do it. She has to, you know, go through hell in order to survive, right? Nicolas Cage, he goes through hell, but at no point does it seem as if he's not enjoying it. You know, like we see him get stabbed in the side and he's fine and he's covered in blood and he's doing drugs and he forges this axe for some reason, and then it's only used to be thrown through the air and murder someone in one shot. There's no drama. There is no question. There is no, it is all just so matter-of-factly presented as, oh, the next thing he does is kill this person, and next thing he does is kill that person.
I think of something like this versus like maybe something like John Wick, right? Which also starts you off, which doesn't immediately start you off with the action either, right? It has to build up the stakes, and then he loses his dog and his wife and everything. He's grieving his wife, and then shit hits the fan, and John Wick can plow through anybody because he's fucking John Wick. What this movie lacks is somebody telling you, oh, God, that fucking lumberjack, he is a crazy person who will kill anybody who gets in his way. We don't get that.
That's not the only difference between this movie and John Wick, but, you know.
I'm just saying, in terms of setting up the characters, like what you guys are pointing out, like, It seems easy that John Wick can also fight everybody, and there's really no sense that he will die throughout those movies. He will beat up hundreds of guys and he's fine. It's perfectly fine because it's John Wick, and we know he is the main character and he can beat whoever he wants.
Yeah, like, I mean, this movie is basically like John Wick if instead of killing hundreds of guys he killed like six guys.
Yeah, six guys who were like demons. I'm totally down with that.
Minus any of the fun, stylish action of John Wick or the cool any of the cool factor. I mean, I don't know. I'm glad you liked it. I don't mean to take anything away from your enjoyment of it. And I'm not faulting this for being a bad movie. I just inherently question the motivation to even make it. Like, what? Why put myself through it? What do I get out of it? I see no reason to watch this film for anyone.
I do feel like this is a movie where if you saw the trailer, Jeff, and you saw what kind of movie this was trying to be, and you could just be like, no, then there you go. That's the power of knowing what you're going to watch.
But then we wouldn't have been talking about it on the podcast.
We wouldn't have. Yeah, but Jeff would have. Yeah, Jeff would have been spared this. This is the flaw in the trailer policy.
My ignorance is your bliss, see, because now we're covering it.
All right, guys, let's wrap it up. Thanks for tuning in. That's our review of Mandy. Find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from adamwarrock.com. Our spoiler bumper comes from filmmaker Kyle Hillinger. Stay tuned to hear what we'll be discussing next week. In the meantime, Jeff Canada, where can you find more of your work on the internet?
Mad that we didn't talk more about You Ripped My Shirt! But anyway,
I referenced it, and I know you did. You guys just gotta pick up the slack here. Come on,
it's a funny moment, but it is literally an actor making fun of the script in real time. It is not. He is saying the line in a way that is not based in any real emotion that's congruent with the scene.
It's very Nicolas Cage. Like, if that line, I don't know if that line was in the script or not. It feels like something of a crazy psycho Nicolas Cage movie that he would put in there. Like, you look at Mom and Dad. There's a point where he is saying ABC in Mom and Dad and getting increasingly more insane as he goes through the letters. Like, it feels like something on that level.
Anyway, I do a video game podcast called DLC that you can find at 5by5.tv/DLC. And you can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T.
How about you, Devendra?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Devendra, and I write about tech at Engadget.com.
Find all of my stuff at DaveChen.net. You can subscribe to my newsletter at DaveChen.net/letters. And next week, we will be doing the second half of our Summer Movie Wager commitment, which is reviewing Minding the Gap, the Hulu documentary that I am forcing everyone to watch. So
my understanding is that it's still anybody's game at this point.
Yeah, I think that's
how it goes. Yeah.
That's correct. Good. Yeah. So tune in for that. That should be a lot of fun. Thanks for listening. We'll see you later. He